his bird note. Ray Youngbear is a writer, musician, and a member of Meskwaki Nation. He considers himself a word collector, writing poetry in both English and Meskwaki, his first language. And he enjoys taking photos of the birds around his home in Iowa. In the spring of 2021, he was spending time with his grandson, Ozzie Youngbear.
We were watching robins around this time, and I just began composing a song based on us watching the robins as they hunted for earthworms. More than anything, to entertain my grandson, to try and coincide the hopping movements of the robin with the song itself. The English translation is Robin, Robin, our grandson enjoys watching you hunt for earthworms, hunt for earthworms.
Ray Youngbear later recorded the song for a music collection called For the Birds, the Birdsong Project. Over 200 musicians, artists, and writers contributed, with proceeds going to the National Audubon Society. Find a link to Ray Youngbear's song and the complete music collection on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Supported and empowered by the students of SFU and listeners like you. For your community, by your community. You are CJSF.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and I'm once again joined by Hale. We're going to be talking about a specific text. I'm going to be bringing up my kind of cursory reading of E.H. Carr's short, famous book, What is History? His acclaimed reflections on the theory of history and the role of the historian. I mean, history is something that you have, I don't want to even say just dabbled in, it's something that you formally studied for a while, but I've had my own kind of run-ins with history, and we've talked about history before. I've said in the past that there's something kind of interesting being a philosophy student encountering history, because it's one place where contingency just kind of rules. Things just happen. I remember when I was studying, kind of getting my toes into ancient Greek, I would supplement it with American history, and it was always really interesting just because things would happen. It was a realm of contingency where in philosophy we're always chasing down necessity. You know, the Western tradition at least starts with, it doesn't start with Parmenides, but it really explodes with Parmenidean necessity, doesn't it?
On the one hand, it almost comes across like anti-metaphysical, anti-logical in some ways, but then at the same time, it also, you also see like a deep-seated themes of a pursuit of certain standards and ideologies around human behavior and how people should be, up against also at the same time a consistent rejection of those, any sort of standard being universally possible for any like length of time, you know, in any kind of like overly generalized way. So I think there is this kind of really interesting tension within philosophy and history. And then there's also like the philosophy or the history of philosophy, which is interestingly kind of always in the background of how philosophy is taught, like in most cases.
That is actually such an interesting point, right? Like when I started studying philosophy, the first textbook, like the first rigorous long textbook that I picked up was Anthony Kenney's A New History of Western Philosophy. And while there's a lot of opportunities for learning philosophy, you know, it's a very dispersed kind of almost tutorial in particular thinkers. It doesn't go too deep. But in a certain way, it does also go beyond the ideas themselves because it's a historical work. But it's also interesting considering that, I mean, if it's not Anthony Kenny's new history, a lot of people have introduced themselves to philosophy through Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy. So history seems to be one way of entering philosophy, and it seems to be working okay. I kind of favor now just throwing people right into Plato. Before we get too far into contingency, which I do want to say too, going into discussing this book, E.H. Carr is going to have some interesting things to say about the role of contingency itself, but we'll put a pin in that for a second. And I was wondering if you had maybe a quick quote or a quandary that we kind of wanted to warm up the show with, maybe.
They're both sort of quotes, and they're both, you know, they both have some quandary to them as well. They're more phrases. Like sometimes if I see an interesting quote, word, or phrase or whatever, I'll like save it in a little file that I have on my phone. And I heard two recently in my, you know, listening and watching of whatever that I thought were kind of interesting and reflective of some phenomena that we see quite frequently, especially in modern media, and particularly within, I watch a pretty considerable amount of like video essays and like kind of cultural, social, or more specific kind of like interest critiques or whatever, right? And all these are often in narrative with each other and can be, sometimes I take a step back and I'm like, why am I listening to this person blather on about this? Sometimes it's stuff that I think is more worthwhile and less just kind of YouTube slop. But alas, this is the kind of content that I do engage with in my personal time. And I've heard a couple phrases that I wrote down that I thought were quite interesting. So the first one is the term semantic fog. And this comes, unsurprisingly, when you think about the term, from a review I was watching. I believe it's a video titled something like What Happened to Jordan Peterson, or Jordan Peterson Lost His Way, or whatever. Jordan Peterson seems like a more and more forgotten intellectual, like, you know, popular intellectual as time goes on. Thankfully, on some level, I think there might be a discussion there of a more of a tragic character than anything. But, you know, for those of you who don't know, I'm sure most of our listeners would at least heard the name. Jordan Peterson was a psychologist from U of T who was quite, you know, was relatively well known within the field of psychology, but not like popularly known. And then got into some, you know, pretty hot debates about, you know, language and names, and particularly sexual orientation pronouns on campus, and it turned into this whole big thing. Became quite a large voice within the culture war, you know, on social media and all this kind of stuff. He became more well known for that more than anything else, and publishing a number of intellectual self-help books and things like that. But anyways, someone was critiquing an interview that he did, and they use the term semantic fog to describe the way he speaks, which I thought was quite good. And really, semantic fog is withdrawing from like any kind of linguistic clarity, usually to avoid making a clear point. So it's a kind of, you know, in a way it could be seen as a little bit of a red herring, where, you know, it's using the complexity of language to disguise that you may not have a point, or that your point doesn't make sense, or to distract from your point because it's not very good, or to, you know, sort of like lessen the weight or your commitment to your point. There's all sorts of ways of using it, but the semantic fog is basically to make whatever you're trying to say less clear, while at the same time also trying to sound more intelligent and intellectual, usually in the process. Which I thought, unfortunately, for Jordan Peterson, is often a way in which he speaks. It's probably a way in which a lot of people would think a lot of philosophers speak as well. But, you know, so I think sometimes they're probably correct in saying that, probably sometimes not. Yeah, I think it is a form of obscurantism. Yeah, absolutely. And then the other one was another phenomena, particularly within the context of personas, media personas. We've talked before about profilicity, how one appears, you know, how one appears within their, as you know, their social media self, their online self, you know, and how they want to appear. And I heard the term used, synthetic credibility, which is really appearing to have knowledge, or you could say like influence or even power in a particular realm or sphere of interest. But it's really based upon manufactured characteristics that can be exclusive to actually having that knowledge or expertise. So the example that I actually used relating to some content that I was watching a while ago was, you know, if you walk into a gym and you see a guy who's really like super jacked and muscular and whatever, you might immediately assume, and he might act as if he's an expert in working out, in physiology, in health or whatever it might be. When in reality, he might actually have got there by taking lots of steroids. He might have all sorts of unhealthy habits. He might even have very inefficient or, frankly, wrong ideas about physical activity or weightlifting or whatever. But because, you know, one appears a certain way, they can rely upon the fact that people will assume that they are, you know, that they're an expert or that they have certain kinds of knowledge or certain kinds of like high levels of intelligence or understanding in certain areas. Or oftentimes that translates into being overall super smart, right? Like another classic synthetic credibility on some level would be, you know, people generally assume, or people who are super rich or extremely wealthy will generally be assumed to be super intelligent or super effective at business or whatever it might be. But that might not necessarily be the case. But they might also use that. I think the important point is using that synthetic credibility to ultimately leverage themselves in the way that they appear to other people.
Yeah, because that's the thing is, if you have, it would be one thing if synthetic credibility didn't work, but the phenomenon of synthetic credibility exists because somehow you can, you know, get by on credibility that you don't actually have. I have my own really quick quotation that comes from the introduction to a translation by Carl Emerson and Michael Hawquist to Mikhail Bakhtin's The Dialogic Imagination, which is four essays of his. I don't know a ton about Mikhail Bakhtin as far as philosophy, as far as being a philosophy student. I understand that he's more a literary theorist, but I know that as a good philosophy student, anything that's worth reading in any other field is worth reading in philosophy, which is also kind of why I'm reading E.H. Carr as well. But one thing from the introduction, just very quickly, kind of struck me. I'll read it and I'll tell you what is, kind of revealing about it, but then I'll tell you what I think is interesting about it. So in the introduction, it says, language, when it means, is somebody talking to somebody else, even when that someone else is one's own inner addressee. Now, there's a kind of Platonic reading to this, you know, thinking is the soul in dialogue with itself. And I think that's in part what the phrase or what that sentence is trying to say, that, hey, it might sometimes appear that we are not addressing anybody, but really, when we are thinking or when we are writing to ourselves or anything like that, even though there is only a single human involved, there's still a speaker and a listener, right? The other thing that is interesting about this is it kind of alludes to the title of the work, The Dialogic Imagination. So even though there's only one, you know, interlocutor, it's still a dialogical relationship. There's still two people involved in a way. But the thing that interests me about this phrase is these three words, when it means, and means is italicized here. And I always get really interested and try to focus, kind of like, you know, we say we lock in. I start to lock in when people use means as a verb in these kinds of contexts, because mean is not like, when we ask, you know, flippantly or almost comically in philosophy, you know, what is the meaning of life, or what is the meaning of this or that or whatever, we always use it as like this abstract noun. But here we're seeing it as a verb. Meaning is something you do, right? So what are we doing when we mean something? And what the sentence is saying is that when we mean something, we are addressing someone. We are using our language to speak to someone else, even when we are addressing ourselves. So meaning is language in a dialogical relationship.
So ultimately, that to me begs like a kind of question. I'm sure you could sort of foresee this, which is like, when is meaning like have no means, for lack of a better, or have no meaning?
I'm just trying to think of like Wittgenstein when he talks about how there might be like metaphysical problems that actually, if you investigate them, they don't really have an addressee, right? So if you ask about like, what is the substance of some kind, you know, what is like a metaphysical substance? Well, language isn't really referring to anything when you're asking what the substance of like a tree is, right? A tree, as far as like a substantial thing, isn't really there. So metaphysically, it's meaningless, right? So your language isn't referring to anything. It's not reaching out and trying to speak to the world in the way that the world is usually referred to as this kind of static thing. And in that way, your language is being meaningless. Every time that language and meaning used as a verb comes up, I said, I kind of start really paying attention, because it sounds like someone, you know, you're in the presence of someone who knows what they're talking about, or at least has a different way of seeing things than most metaphysical philosophers see things. I kind of left us off talking about contingency in history. In E.H. Carr's work, What is History? This is one of the things that he tries to argue for, or I should say more specifically against, right? You and I, we both are really excited by history because, unlike in philosophy, it offers fresh new views all the time. Things just happen. You know, someone just like kind of starts doing something and then everyone else starts doing it, and it's this whole movement, you know? Now, E.H. Carr wants, actually, one of his projects in What is History is to not necessarily reject contingency, and as if to say like, oh, there are these immutable historical laws or something like that. He wants to reject that as well. But he also wants to reject a certain kind of picture of doing history or doing historiography that relies on flippant kind of contingencies. So the kind of icon that he has for this is he uses Cleopatra's nose, right? So I can't remember specifically what historical event, you know, transpired because of the shape of Cleopatra's nose, but I think it was the losing of a particular battle that then leads to like the fall of Egypt. And historiographers will sometimes cite Cleopatra's nose as attracting a certain a man to her, which leads her into certain relationships, which leads to the downfall of Egypt, right? E.H. Carr wants to kind of temper this kind of contingency, right? It's not the kind of contingency that I get excited by when I see and am reading, you know, history. Like, for example, in American history, you have the Civil War, and then you have Abraham Lincoln, who is going to begin Reconstruction, and then he gets assassinated, right? That's the kind of contingency that I'm interested in. It's not really the contingency of like, I don't know, someone took a left turn somewhere and then they really, you know, that really changed the course of history. But in any case, the reason that E.H. Carr wants to reject this, though, goes into the larger framework of the way that he sees that history is done. And one of the important things that he stresses about the way that history is done, and again, this is kind of bucking the typical way that historians at least understood themselves, I should say, that this book was released in 1961. It didn't get a second edition, but he did revise it and work on it throughout the remainder of his life. It was released in 1961, and he died in 1986, I believe. He was born in 1896. In any case, this book is, with historians, it's not necessarily controversial, but it does go against a lot of what historians at least took themselves to be doing when they did history. And one of the things that historians take themselves to be doing is collecting facts and arranging facts in an objective sort of order in order to explain the events of history, right? Now, what Carr wants to say about this is that actually, yes, there are facts. Like, that's completely commonsensical. No one is really disputing that there are these things called facts, right? Facts being descriptions of a state of the world that is or was true, right? What's significant for E.H. Carr, though, is that he wants to make a distinction between facts. I think he uses the terms facts of the past to distinguish them from historical facts, right? So one of the things that he says is, yes, like, Caesar crosses the Rubicon, right? But why is that a historical fact versus, you know, the thousands of perhaps millions of people who crossed the Rubicon since or before then, right? For some reason, Caesar's crossing the Rubicon is a significant fact. It has historical value, whereas the fact of the people who cross the Rubicon every day to, like, get to work or something, those don't have historical value, right? So he wants to make this distinction. And in making this distinction, he wants to kind of depart from facts as these value neutral things, as just saying that facts are these objective things that historians go out and collect, that really what we're doing is engaging in a, like, pure science. He does think that historians are engaged in a science, and that historians have an objectivity to which they're kind of responsible to in doing history. But that objectivity, paradoxically, is also kind of tied to a subjective, not a subjective, but a historical standard that can only be instantiated in a kind of subjective ideal or standard, if that makes any sense. The point here, though, is that E.H. Carr is taking aim at a kind of, I don't want to say, like, well, if historians take themselves to be doing science, and that history is a science, he sort of jeopardizes it by saying the facts that you are using have value, right? And that in itself threatens your science. It puts your science in realm, it puts your science outside of being, like, outside of the subject itself, right? Like, you can't say that history is outside of a history itself, right? There have been thinkers who have tried to posit, like, a sort of super historical standard by which you can measure history. But if you really think about it, if it's human beings who are coming up with and positing this super historical standard, that standard is itself historical, right? So it's subject to history itself. And not only that, if it's something that historians are going to take account of, that itself is something that historians view as a historical fact and not just, like, a fact of the past. You know, if Marx posits he mentions Marx in various points and whatnot, and all kinds of different philosophers of history, Hegel, Adam Smith, and whatnot. But for take your pick of whatever historical standard that you want, those themselves are historical. They emerge in history, and the fact that they are important in history are things that later historians select for in their history.
This isn't a book that I have read. It is work that I'm vaguely familiar with. I know it's come up in some other works that I have been interested in. There's also, as someone who's been generally interested in history, as a sort of casual, at one point, somewhat academic interest, but certainly a very consistently very active hobby in one way or another. You know, there's a blend that happens with being having that kind of interest in history and also having that kind of interest in philosophy, because obviously you become interested in the theory or perhaps ideology behind history, how history happens. You know, you start asking the classic philosopher moment of, like, you know, why is history the way it is? And I think that, you know, Ichikar is trying to walk between the two sort of ends of the scale. You know, how you have this sort of very the chaotic view of history, where it's like all sorts of realms of hyper-specific contingency fit together. This, like, to me always seems absurd, because there's obviously the obvious counterpoint of, like, you know, we as modern persons doing history or trying to understand history are, you know, our salient facts are exceptionally narrow, right? Like, and I don't mean that in terms of, like, what salient facts at the time were narrow. I mean that in the sense of, like, what we have is extremely narrow. And generally speaking, the farther back you go, the more narrow that becomes, right? So, like, we rely upon very few sources, or we rely upon archaeology that oftentimes is not definitive or has a very limited information generally. And then also, too, how do individuals from all the way from very casual learners like me to full-on historians, how do they gain access to that information? How do they have what they have in front of them? How can they be sure it's the broadest picture or the best picture possible, probably a better way of saying it, that they can then sort of, as you would say, like, piece it together? The flip side of that is that, like, you know, you start to enter a much more sort of Hegelian Marxist sort of view of history, which is much more, like, structured and sort of law and order driven. I don't mean law and order in the actual, like, judicial sense, but I mean, like, there are historical laws and it orders things in a very particular way. And that makes historical trends and events almost kind of, like, predictable, right? Like, you know, like the classic, you know, empires, you know, form into, like, the capitalistic states or whatever, which eventually turn into, like, fascist totalitarian police states, which collapse on themselves, or, you know, whatever, right? Like, there's all sorts of different ways of kind of viewing this. And again, there's always very obvious counterexamples, and things just don't seem to work out super clearly. I think that section is also, as I'm sure Carr and everyone else would be aware, is very revealing of a historian's own personal motivations, whether that be deeply personal and private to themselves, or I think in many cases, much more culturally, socially, you know, even economically driven to portray or understand their history, their world in a very particular kind of way that fits a larger sort of existence, for lack of a way of putting it.
One way that historians have sort of reacted to this is to say that Carr is kind of, like, subjectivizing or even criticizing history itself, trying to undermine it by saying that it's all just kind of subjective, or that historians have their agendas and their biases, and that we'll never really get to true objective facts. I think Carr is doing something a bit more sophisticated, and he's saying that actually you have to have a bias to engage with this stuff. Like, that's the condition for seeing facts as historically salient, right?
I think that's an obvious thing when you start to think about it, because it's like, okay, well, if history is like one way, I know someone told me, you know, you asked the question, what is history? What is the, you know, on the ontology of history? And history is, you know, is a particular, you know, narrative formation of the past. Well, you have to have the past is a big thing. Like, in the past, everything that's ever happened has happened. So why are you, like, why is it that you're concerned with, you know, Napoleon at Austerlitz or whatever, and not, you know, how many blades of grass blew on his lawn, you know, that day at the, his whatever chateau he was living in, or, you know, how many persons were born in some specific town in Germany, or the life of some guy who professionally made like fishing line, you know, on the coast of